Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it mean to support our troops? Do those yellow ribbon stickers and car magnets mean anything to the returning veterans who cannot access the care they need to pick up their lives where they left off? Aaron Glantz first experienced the Iraq War as an embedded journalist, often reporting on Iraqi civilians terrified of their American occupiers. Glantz himself was once nearly shot at point-blank range by a soldier who mistook him for an Iraqi national. Returning home with symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, Glantz began to consider the impact of the conflict on U.S. soldiers themselves, once regular people forced to live for months and years under constant life and death pressure. And he learned that while U.S. troops are often called heroes, hundreds of thousands of them face yet another fight at home, trying to readjust to civilian life and secure the benefits they thought they had already earned. Glantz's new book is called The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. Aaron, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You quote Richard Severo in the book who says, "Wounded veterans are not a pleasant thing to think about." Are we just afraid to face what the war has done to these people?
Well, I think that Richard Severo was a New York Times journalist who covered the Agent Orange catastrophe for our Vietnam veterans. And he documented very clearly how the government battled Vietnam veterans coming home from that war tooth and nail to try to prevent them from getting the care that they needed from being poisoned with Agent Orange, and to give them disability compensation because they couldn't work or because their children had birth defects. And I asked him, why did he think that was the case? Why did he think that successive administrations, starting with the Nixon administration, the Ford administration, the Carter administration, the Reagan administration, all the way up to the Clinton administration, were completely unhelpful to Vietnam veterans. And he said, you know, when the war in Vietnam ended, everyone just wanted to sweep it under the rug. They wanted to forget that it happened because it had been such an unpleasant experience for our country. And they just wanted to move on and forget about it. But the problem was there were 3 million Vietnam veterans who had experienced the war, many of whom had come home with post-traumatic stress disorder, with chemical poisoning, with other physical wounds, and we just did our best to forget about them. And then here we are, you know, 40 years later after the war in Vietnam, and we have 200,000 homeless veterans on the streets of this country. And I guess what I'm trying to do in my book, The War Comes Home, is stand here now before this catastrophe repeats itself with the Iraq War generation and say, hey, this is something we got to do something about now when these guys are coming home from the war.
Yeah, you have an interesting sort of case study in the book about the guys who came home from World War II and the fact that they were really helped out by the American Legion, which, you know, the first members of that had served in World War I.
Yes, and you may remember that the World War I generation also had to protest to get their benefits. They actually had what was called a bonus march on Washington. The Hoover administration denied them the benefits that they earned in World War I, and they actually occupied the Capitol Mall in Washington, D.C., and were driven off by the U.S. military led by Douglas MacArthur and General Patton. And there was a real sense during World War II that it was going to be unacceptable to let that happen again. And so the American Legion veterans, who, as you mentioned, many of them were World War I veterans, when people started coming home in the middle of World War II, 1943, 1944, when the war was still going on, and they were ending up homeless on the street, the Legion published in their magazine a series of very scathing articles documenting this, took it around the halls of Congress, also got support from the major media in this country, especially William Randolph Hearst. And when the war ended in 1945, we had a tremendously excellent GI Bill of Rights, which included the whole gamut, you know, from education benefit, housing benefit, health care benefit, disability benefit, all the things that you get promised on the front end, the World War II generation actually got on the back end. But unfortunately, in this century, that's been the exception rather than the rule.
Now, there was a new GI Bill signed last year. What's in it?
Well, this is the good news. Since I started reporting on the war and veterans of this war, and the war is now 6 years old in Iraq and 8 years old in Afghanistan, not much has changed, unfortunately. The Washington Post coverage of the scandal at Walter Reed did not improve conditions for medical care for our returning servicemen in a meaningful way. We still have tremendous backlogs for people who come home and file for disability after serving in the war. It's still very hard to get health care and medical care, but there was a new GI Bill of Rights that was passed by Congress and signed over by President Bush over his own objections. They snuck it in another bill. And this this does give you, if you served in Iraq and Afghanistan, beginning in August of this year, the federal government will pay for your full college tuition at any public university in your state, plus a living stipend. And this is very important. And it's a great opportunity, and it's a great place to start, but it's only one piece of the puzzle.
There is an overwhelming sense, Aaron, throughout this book of surprise. These veterans that you profile never imagined that they wouldn't have their service-related needs met upon returning home.
The veterans who signed up thought that they would get what they were promised, and by and large, they had to fight for it. And that's why, you know, when I first started writing this book, I just called it The War Comes Home, because having been in Iraq myself over the course of 3 years and having the experience of coming home from war and knowing personally how difficult that can be, I wanted to write a book that showed your average American person, maybe even a family member of a veteran, what their relatives are going through psychologically and physically when they come home from the front. But as I researched the book, as I interviewed more and more veterans, I realized that I had to call the book The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, because our system is set up in such a way that our veterans have to battle for every single benefit that they're promised when they come in. And that's why people fall through the cracks. That's why we have record numbers of suicides amongst our veterans, 18 suicides every day in this country among our veteran population. We had more members of the active duty Army commit suicide last month than we had die in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, these are some things that a lot of people find very surprising when I say them on the radio on a program like this one, and they're extremely hard to understand unless you put them in the context of everything that's going on, which is what I try to do in the book.
Mm-hmm. How common is post-traumatic stress disorder among post-9/11 veterans?
Well, according to the RAND Corporation, first of all, we have 1.8 million Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans. Almost 2 million Americans have served in these two wars. And for a sense of perspective, we had 3 million Vietnam-era veterans. So we are now coming up on having roughly the same number of Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans by the time this is over as we have Vietnam veterans in this country. According to the RAND Corporation, 300,000 veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan are coming home with post-traumatic stress disorder or major depression. In other words, they have left the war zone and come home, but in their mind, they are still over there. In addition to that, we have another 300,000 veterans who suffer from traumatic brain injury, and that's a physical brain damage, a concussion, another kind of a shaken, your brain got shaken up during one of the many IED explosions that happens over there, or perhaps in an auto accident. There are a lot of auto accidents brought on by explosions in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so we have 300,000 with post-traumatic stress disorder, another 300,000 with traumatic brain injury. And these numbers are staggering. We have not seen this many wounded before, but we see it for two reasons. The first is the number of tours that people have to go in these wars. In Vietnam, your average soldier was drafted and came home 1 year to the day after they went to Vietnam and never had to go back again. In this war, people are going 2, 3, 4, 5, sometimes even 6 times, and they're sustaining multiple traumatic brain injuries, or they have a traumatic brain injury, and then they develop post-traumatic stress disorder due to the repeated exposure to terrible things on the battlefield, or the loss of their compatriots, or the people that they had to kill in grappling with the morality of that on a day-to-day basis in their own mind. And the other reason that these numbers are so high is that people are surviving. We have excellent battlefield medicine. We have excellent body armor as compared with the Vietnam era. So we had 57,000 American soldiers die in Vietnam. We have 5,000 American soldiers who have perished in Iraq and Afghanistan. But that doesn't mean that they're unaffected by the war just because they survived and were able to make it home.
And a diagnosis of PTSD is not enough to keep a soldier from being redeployed. Is that correct?
That's correct. One of the things the Bush administration did during this war is they actually changed the Pentagon's policy to allow for the deployment of people who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, and also people who suffer from mild traumatic brain injury. So we have people over there fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan right now who are heavily medicated with psychotropic drugs. And we have people fighting over there right now in Iraq and Afghanistan who have short-term memory loss, who have migraine headaches, who have lousy hand-eye coordination because they have some physical brain damage from an explosion that they sustained in an earlier tour. And this is going to be something that we're going to continue to see the effects of for some time. And it's another reason why we have an escalating suicide rate.
And in some cases, symptoms of either those traumatic brain injuries or mental illness brought on by combat actually put sufferers at risk for losing their benefits altogether when they come back.
Yes. I chronicle many, many stories in this book of people who came back from the war and were having trouble adjusting, either because they had post-traumatic stress disorder or just they had integration issues. It's tough to go to war and come back, and everyone around you is talking about Britney Spears and her latest antics, and you're thinking about your friend who just died. That's not an easy thing to deal with in general. And then if on top of that you have post-traumatic stress disorder, you're having flashbacks, you can't sleep at night, you know, a lot of people come home and they sleep with their weapon because when you're over in Iraq, you sleep with your weapon every night. You have to have it in case there's an attack. You come home and the next day you're home and the military brass says, you know what, you're completely safe now. But it's hard to turn that off when it's been on for over a year while you've been in the war. It's not easy to feel secure in your own home. And so, you know, some people, because that care is not accessible, begin to smoke pot, begin to drink as a way of dulling the pain or as a way of trying to mellow out some of their symptoms. And we have thousands of American veterans and soldiers who have been dishonorably discharged for beating their spouse after serving multiple tours in Iraq or for smoking marijuana. I have one person that I profile in the book, Staff Sergeant Don Hanks of Tacoma, Washington, who served 14 years in the U.S. Army. And after his tour in Iraq, he had post-traumatic stress disorder. He went to try to get care. The Army wouldn't give it to him, so he started smoking pot. Then he failed the drug test. They kicked him out for failing the drug test, and now he has no access to any kind of care because of his dishonorable discharge.
Aaron Glantz is my guest. He is a journalist whose new book is called The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is journalist Aaron Glantz. His new book is called The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk, Aaron, about another aspect of mental health, which is personality disorder. Soldiers who are diagnosed with this are presumed to have lied about it when they enlisted, even though, in many cases, the disease did not manifest until they were exposed to combat.
Well, this is the easy out that the Pentagon has if they have a soldier on their hands who is not deployable, and they're under tremendous pressure to either deploy the soldier or to get them out of the military as quickly as possible so they can replace him with somebody else and save money on the medical care.
This is a dishonorable discharge situation.
Is to give them a personality disorder discharge. And this means that they're basically have a problem and they're non-functional in a social situation. And they can't get along with anybody that they work with, so they can't have them in the Army. And the problem is that with this war, we have thousands of people who don't get this personality disorder discharge, this discharge of a pre-existing condition of mental illness, until after they've already served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they get discharged with a personality disorder discharge, and then they have no access to the health care that we promised them after they get out.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Griff in Fort Worth. Hi, Griff.
Hi. I was going to say that I served in the military at the end of the Vietnam War. In fact, I was involved in the evacuation of Saigon. And I don't remember anybody giving me any long-term promises about health care, so that's just one comment I have. And then another comment I have is that I grew up in the 1950s, and all the dads in my neighborhood were World War II veterans, and some had seen combat. And the more and more I think about some of their behaviors when I was a young man, and they were, you know, men in their 40s, was that they, all the ones that had been in combat, were exhibiting some form of symptoms of PTSD, like not allowing us little boys to run around and make machine gun noises when we had our model airplanes chasing each other around the yard, you know. And as they got older, some of these people actually got worse, and I made a model of a destroyer for one of them, and he had it in his house for a week and gave it away because he couldn't stand to look at the ship he was on in World War II. It had too many bad memories. He remembered the kamikazes. He remembered all the other stuff that went on. And I have a friend who's a retired Marine Corps colonel in San Antonio, and he's in his 80s, and he's going for counseling with his PTSD because he wakes up in the middle of the night and he smells the blood and the sulfur from Iwo Jima, you know, like in the movie Flags of Our Fathers. And the thing is, every time we have a war, it seems like people think that PTSD is a new phenomenon, and my humble opinion is that it's been going on as long as modern war. Now, the thing
those are great points, and I think it does point out the fact, Aaron, that PTSD is not a condition that is easily treated, and it's not something that is curable as far as we know.
Well, the good news is that we have a much better idea of what happens to the human mind under tremendous stress than we did after World War II. You know, after World War I, we called this shell shock, so it's not a new phenomenon. We've known about this for generations, as the caller is saying, but every time, it seems, after every war, we have to get into the same debate. We don't learn from the previous war. Post-traumatic stress disorder didn't exist as a diagnosis after Vietnam, and the Vietnam veterans had to fight to get recognized that they were having a normal reaction to combat. Luckily, we have some progress this time in that the Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans don't have to prove that PTSD exists. But unfortunately, they're still running up against a system that doesn't want to care for them. If you go to Iraq or Afghanistan and you come back and you can't sleep at night and you're having trouble adjusting and you think you might have post-traumatic stress disorder, the first thing that the VA makes you do is fill out a 26-page form where you have to talk about exactly the incident that traumatized you. You have to get letters from your military buddies and your commanding officers to corroborate that this incident occurred. People who help veterans file disability claims note that it's a good idea to file a Freedom of Information Act request on yourself and perhaps copy your congressman so the VA knows that your congressman is paying attention. It's a tremendous fight just to get in the door. And these are people who are in the moment of being the most shell-shocked. And I think that, you know, one of the things the caller just said is really important, is after World War II, I mean, so many Americans fought in World War II. And so there wasn't this feeling of loneliness and isolation that we have after the Iraq War, where, yes, we have almost 2 million Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans. We also have 300 million American people, and so it's so easy to feel isolated. And when the VA, you know, throws all this paperwork at you and tries to discourage you from coming in to save money, so many people, you know, just to say, oh, I'm going to tough it out by myself. The VA is not going to help me anyway. And that can lead to suicide.
There have been some serious suggestions that instead of sending all of these folks to the VA, that we might consider giving them a voucher of some kind so that they could have their needs treated in the private healthcare system. What are the pros and cons of that?
Well, I think that we have a great resource in our VA hospitals. We have a great system for our wounded veterans. The problem is that we're trying to do it on the cheap. So we have a great network of hospitals all around the country where we have dedicated practitioners, some of the best in the business at treating combat stress, the best in the business with prosthetics for amputees, the best in the business for this brain injury in the VA system. The problem is we've set up a bureaucracy to keep people out. And so I think that if we can make the system more user-friendly, if we can end the battle that our veterans have to fight, then we won't need to be having this discussion about the private sector.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Montana in Dallas. Hi, Montana.
Hi. First-time caller, very disgusted listener at this point.
Well, tell us why.
I'm a veteran. I'm a Vietnam vet. I was a helicopter door gunner for a year and a day. And some of these things that he's talking about, yes, there are some things that a man goes through when he has to face his demons and he has to face them at night. You are putting a lot of responsibility on the government. We are all human. We all face things differently. And I can tell you straight up that I have been there where three of us have seen something together, and all three of us came away with different points of views and different reactions.
Absolutely.
Now, my point is that I'm taking you coming from a leftist point of view. War is hell. Yet you are the guys that want us to go to battle for you, for your cause. But if it's something that is in generality, is that in something that you want us to do it for, then you attack us. You attack the government. You attack the soldier. I am disgusted by that. I think you are really doing more harm to us with your books and your points of views and getting on the radio and saying what you're saying than standing up and saying, hey, look, we do have problems. But that's part of being a man. That's part of being an American. That's part of being a soldier.
Well, Montana, you brought up a lot of good points, and I do want to give Aaron a chance to respond.
Well, I don't mean to be saying anything negative about the people who have served our country in these wars. In fact, what I'm saying is that the government isn't doing enough to take care of people when they come home. And the caller is absolutely right. Montana is absolutely right that three people can be present at the same incident, and two of them can come home just fine, and the third can come home ruined. And we need to make sure that that third person who comes home and is having trouble adjusting, that the path of transition to civilian life is easy, and that we don't make them fight for their benefits. And I'm sorry if it sounds hostile, because it's absolutely not meant to be that way at all.
Why are there such shortages at VA healthcare facilities right now in terms of personnel?
The Bush administration, I mean, think back to 2002 when they first started talking to us about the possibility of a war in Iraq or a war. Donald Rumsfeld went in front of the television and he said the war might last 6 days. It might last 6 weeks. He doubted 6 months. Here we are 6 years later. There's been a lot of discussion about how the Bush administration failed to plan properly for the execution of the war on the battlefield. They also failed to plan properly for the crisis that faces our veterans at home. And people came to President Bush, and they said, President Bush, you are starting a war. Whether you think the war is right or wrong, it will have casualties. People will come home wounded and disabled. And we need to hire doctors. We need to hire nurses. We need to hire disability claims adjudicators so there's not a big backlog in disability claims. And he shot them down. He fired his Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Anthony Principi, when he made that argument. And he brought in a guy, Jim Nicholson, who's a former real estate developer from Colorado, who helped manage his Florida recount in 2000. And he replaced Principi with Nicholson. He replaced the woman who was heading up the mental health assessment effort at the VA to make sure there was enough mental health available for our returning veterans. She found that the mental health care available to our veterans was so inaccessible as to be worthless. She was also fired. So there was a real attempt, I would say until the Washington Post story on the conditions at Walter Reed, by the Bush administration to completely sweep the idea of casualties under the rug. Now, with President Obama, we have somebody who had a good record in the Senate on these issues. We have somebody who talked a good game when he was running for president. But this is a issue that takes a great degree of leadership and follow through, and the proof will be in the pudding as to whether he solves these problems.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Aaron Glantz is my guest. His new book is called The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. Let's speak next with Herschel in Dallas. Hi, Herschel.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
First of all, I think the best way of dealing or ensuring that soldiers don't have post-traumatic stress disorder is not to fight wars to begin with. I think that's the first thing. The other thing I need to mention, my son is an Army psychologist that's based in Walter Reed.
Mm.
And he served a tour of duty in Iraq. And we've had a long number of discussions. I am a child of the 60s. I didn't serve in Vietnam. I was 3A when I registered for the draft. I had kids. I was in college, a variety of other things. But I had a number of friends that went through that situation. And I guess the discussions I've had with my son, and based on, you know, the environment during the Vietnam War and the concerns about it being an unpopular war like this one is the government really doing everything they can? Are they trying to put a Band-Aid on the guys that suffer these either physically or mentally disabilities to get them back out there again or get rid of them? Or are they genuinely concerned about what happens to them? Now, I think my son is concerned that when you're in that environment, when you're part of the system, are you aware of that, or do you have the independence to really do what that particular person in front of you needs, or are you trying to take care of the company line, I guess is what my question is. And, I'll listen to your response, and I've got a few other comments to make as well, but Montana, the guy that called in, I understand his frustrations and pain. One of the things that happened in Vietnam and also in this war, it was an unpopular war.
Herschel, I'm sorry to have to interrupt you, but we have lots of people on the line. I do want Aaron to be able to respond
to your primary point. Okay.
Thanks so much for your call.
Well, I think, first of all, I want to thank Herschel for his service and also for the great work that I'm sure his son is doing right now, both in Iraq and here at home. There are so many people in the system on the front lines who are doing everything they can. I profile a lot of them in my book. I talk about the former chief neurosurgeon at Landstuhl who's taking people who suffer these IED attacks and helping them not incur permanent heavy brain damage as a result. We have tremendous advances in medical science. We have tremendously dedicated professionals working in the military and at the VA. Our problem is that our system has put in all of these gatekeepers to keep the veteran from accessing them. And that's what I'm talking about when I say the war comes home, Washington's battle against America's veterans. It's not the frontline psychologists or psychiatrists or neurosurgeons who are battling with our veterans. It's the politicians in Washington who have set up a system that makes it hard for those dedicated professionals to operate.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. The email address is think@kera.org. I want to talk for a minute, Aaron, about whether or not families are prepared in any formal way for what they're going to have to deal with when their loved ones return from the war in Iraq or Afghanistan.
I think maybe it's getting a little bit better now, but families are totally unprepared. And especially in this war, where such a high percentage of the people who serve are a National Guard and Reserve, you know, people who signed up to serve one weekend a month, people who signed up to take care of their community in the case of a natural disaster, who have now been in Iraq or been in Afghanistan. And, you know, I tell this one story, for example, of a gentleman from the suburban Chicago who was sent to guard Guantanamo Bay detainees in the early parts of this war on terror. And, you know, he had to spend a lot of time away from his children who were very, very young, and they didn't understand where daddy went. And his wife had a terrible time trying to hold that family together during the deployment, because being in the National Guard, he never imagined, and his wife was totally unprepared for this turn of events. And you know, especially with the multiple tours, we have a situation where people who have maybe served three tours in Iraq by now, let's say they have a four-year-old son. That means that the first 3 years of their four-year-old son's life, daddy has been gone or mommy has been gone. We have also a lot, I think another thing that's new with this war, with the high number of female service members, is we have a number of military couples where mom and dad are both in the Army, and they both get deployed.
Aaron Glantz is with us. His new book is called The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. We'll return to the conversation in a moment. You're welcome to join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Aaron Glantz. His new book is called The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Lee in Fort Worth. Hi, Lee.
Hi. I'd just like to make a couple of comments. One is there's a tremendous John Wayne mythology in this country that that human beings are supposed to go through, you know, this combat experience and come back and just be, you know, G.I. Joe tough. The second thing is that while PTSD may certainly be caused by one extremely traumatic event, there's also a possibility with these guys going back for multiple tours that what you're looking at is a cumulative effect. That's often seen in other stress disorders. And as far as Montana's comments, I wonder how he would have fared if he had gone back for, you know, three or four tours as a door gunner in Vietnam. And that's all I have to say.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
It is interesting, the idea that, you know, having to document an injury, Aaron, that has caused PTSD or an event seems to be almost exactly the opposite of what most victims of PTSD want to do, which is to confront what happened to them.
Well, I mean, you need to get the help so that you can confront what happened. But the whole reason that you're coming in for help is that it's difficult for you to, you know, figure out exactly what is wrong with you. I mean, I think the caller is exactly right about the cumulative nature of the layering of traumatic experiences. I know that's why I don't go back to Iraq again after three trips over there extended myself, because I don't think there's any one thing that I experienced that caused me to have some trouble when I came home. I think it was a cumulative array of experiences that I had. But if I was going to the VA for help, I would need to pick one of them and document it and say in my paperwork that that was why I was screwed up. And then I would need to, like I said before, have this extremely thick case file that I developed. And somebody was just saying to me yesterday, I was interviewing somebody in Denver, and he was saying the biggest determining factor as to whether your claim gets approved by the VA is sometimes how thick your file is, if you've been able to, you know, get enough random pieces of paperwork together. And the really sad thing is all of this could be fixed if we just made our VA work along the lines of the IRS. The IRS, most people don't like the IRS.
It's a funny comparison to make.
Yeah, I mean, like, for me to say that we should make the VA like the IRS to make it better maybe lets you know how screwed up the VA is. But if you think about it, you're getting your W-2s, your 1099s in the mail now. You can put your taxes together, mail your tax return into the federal government, and you tell the IRS that you deserve a refund, and they just mail it to you. Later on, they're going to audit you, and they're going to check and make sure that you're telling the truth. But our veteran system is not set up in a way that is that friendly. For our wounded veterans coming home, they need to affirmatively prove that they deserve the benefit before they get a dime. And the effect of that is devastating. I tell the story in my book of James Eggemeyer of Stuart, Florida, who came back after serving a tour in Iraq. He had a back injury, a shoulder injury, and he also had post-traumatic stress disorder. One of his jobs in Iraq was he was a convoy driver, and after the accidents or the gun battles that they would see, one of his jobs was to load the bodies of the dead onto helicopters to be taken away. And that was not an easy job to do, and he came back with PTSD. And he filed his disability claim shortly after coming home, and he couldn't work. And in the 8 months that it took the VA to adjudicate his disability claim, he lost his house, he lost contact with his son, he had to move into his truck, he was popping a pain medication like nobody's business because he couldn't get into the health system, so he crashed his truck, and if it hadn't been for charity in the community, he would have literally been living homeless on the street of Stuart, Florida, less than a year after coming back from Iraq. And it didn't need to be that way, because in the end, the VA agreed that he was disabled from his service, and they gave him a check. If they would have just given him that check on the front end, he would have never ended up in the situation that he was in.
Let's speak next to Eamon in Weatherford. Hi, Eamon.
Hi, I'm only 21, and my father was in Vietnam for about 8 months, and following that, he came back, and he told me that he threw away his uniform, and he worked riding fence on a ranch in West Texas for about 4 years, and he was completely by himself, and he managed to adjust himself, I guess, to society and go on and get married and have children, but even to this day, I was told that the reason we never ate Asian food when I was a kid was because the smell of cooking with soybean oil reminded him of the smell of burning soy fields mixed with the smell of burning bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And now I have friends who just out of high school signed up just because their parents were in the military and are now coming back and maybe aren't deeply, deeply affected by it, but still have some issues with the kind of things that they had to deal with. So what I was going to ask was, what kind of support can we offer and what hope is there for people who either aren't going to get any benefits from the government as far as care or aren't even going to apply?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. I have 24, in my book, I have 24 resource boxes of different resources that are available in the community for veterans away from the government system, whether it's getting readjustment counseling, whether it's getting help with a lawyer if you're battling your VA claim, or getting help in the community for a job or whatever. I think it's very important that we recognize that we all have a responsibility here, and there are other places to go besides the government. I think that that's very important. I think each of us needs to attack this issue from the place that we sit. So, for example, if you work at a community college, you know, why not help start help the veterans at your community college start a veterans club, or encourage just the college to turn one room over to you know, kind of a veterans center, just put a couch and a coffee maker and a bunch of signs up to let veterans know that if they want to hang out there and be away from the rest of the student body for a little bit in just a safe space to talk about their experiences with other vets, that that's available to them. And so that's what I think, that's what I would say, is just think about where you are. If you have friends who are just coming back from Iraq, you know, be there for them. Listen to what they have to say. Don't push them. Be patient. But if they want to talk, be available.
I have read some interesting stories about veterans returning from being soldiers and then starting the beginning of what will become their university career and being really frustrated to be suddenly dropped into an environment where there's a lot of talk about parties and you know, social life, and really they're not in the same place as the other 20 or 22-year-olds that they're surrounded
by. Well, I mean, they tend to be older, mm-hmm. you know, because if you signed up for the military, you might have served 3 or 4 years in the military, so the other students are 17 or 18, and they've never been out of their parents' house before, and you're 24, and you're just back from Iraq. And that's if you don't have any PTSD or traumatic brain injury or anything like that. And so I think that, you know, we need to think about where veterans go. One place they go is school, and how we can create more community at school or create a more understanding atmosphere in the workplace. You know, a lot of our National Guards and Reservists are leaving a job and going to serve their country in Iraq and coming back to the same job with a whole bunch of people who haven't been over there. And their employers, I was talking to the head of an employer federation, they're really confused about what they should be doing. So it isn't just a job for the VA and the government, but none of the rest of this, I think, will really work out unless the government, in a systematic way, steps up and does its job.
I know that the VA does have a limited number of ombudsmen, people who are employed to sort of help people navigate the system. Are there just not enough of those to go around, or are they not very useful?
Well, I mean, I think that the whole system is not set up in a way that's friendly for veterans. And so there can be an ombudsman, but what would be better would be to change the system. You know, so, for example, I tell the story in the book of Jeffrey Lucy, who was in the Marine Corps, and he served in the invasion of Iraq, and he came home and he dropped out of school and he started to drink to excess, and he was exhibiting many of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, and, you know, he wanted to be tough. He didn't want to go in and get help, but eventually his parents convinced him to go to the VA in Leeds, Massachusetts. And when he got to the VA, he told them how he planned to kill himself. He told the VA that he was suicidal and that he planned to kill himself, and they turned him away. And then 2 weeks later, he hung himself with a garden hose in his parents' basement. Now, you asked me about ombudsman. After he died, the inspector general of the VA came in and did an investigation, and he said that the VA acted inappropriately. And the VA actually paid out relatively recently a $350,000 settlement to his parents for wrongful death. But none of that helps bring him back to life. And so we have to, you know, be better on the front end rather than on the back end.
Given the amount of time, Aaron, that we spend in this country talking about the heroism of our troops, why is it that more Americans are not up in arms about this and sort of actively working to change it?
Well, I think that we talked earlier about the small percentage of Americans that are directly involved in this war. I think one of the callers raised the issue that we have this John Wayne mentality. You know, we want to talk about our soldiers as heroes, but we don't want to talk about what they do and how that, you know, whether you're for or against the war, just the tremendous physical and emotional toll that that takes. We are afraid to engage with the idea of war. And I think that that explains a lot of, you know, where we are today with the departure of President Bush and the entry of President Obama. You know, people want President Obama to turn the page. They want him to make us forget about the bad things that happened under President Bush. And Instead, what we need to do is be engaged in this for the long haul, and we need to understand that for those people who served in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and for the Iraqi and Afghan people also, that the story is really just beginning.
How much of what lacks for our returning veterans has to do with money?
I think that only a small portion of it has to do with money. You know, I was talking earlier about how we could completely turn the disability claims process on its head so people didn't have to wait months or years for a disability check when they come home wounded from the war. Doing that would cost about 2% of the annual cost of the war in Iraq. We're about to throw $850 billion into a stimulus package, you know, to save our economy or to throw it down the drain, depending on how you look at it. And the amount of money that we'd be talking about in terms of solving this problem is peanuts by comparison. I think it's really about focus, and it's about leadership. And we need our politicians to lead, and we need to lead in the grassroots. So like the previous caller said, we all need to be thinking about what we can do in our own communities to help those around us.
You talked a little bit earlier about having gone to Iraq yourself as a journalist. Mm-hmm. Do you feel permanently changed, if not damaged, by your experiences?
I definitely feel changed. I definitely think it's the case. It's a cliche, but it has truth to it that nobody comes back from war the same. I am not the same person that I was in 2002. I look at the world in an entirely different way, and I still have symptoms sometimes, and I write about them in the book. Sometimes I... You know, especially if there's somebody says something that can trigger it. You know, like I was at a journalism conference in San Jose, California, and somebody from the Dias was talking about the number of murders that we have in San Francisco now and was saying that it's just like Baghdad. It was, of course, is nothing like Baghdad, and that started to get me angry. And then I started to see, you know, some of the things that I saw in Baghdad right in front of my eyes, and it was not daydreaming. I mean, it was very, very real. And I think that, you know, some of the Vietnam veterans who called in today and, you know, talking also about the World War II generation, I don't think it ever leaves you. But on the other hand, you know, here I am. I'm a successful journalist. I'm doing my best. I have a marriage that's working out. And I think that just because you come home changed doesn't mean it doesn't mean that it has to destroy you. The only reason it would destroy you is if the government isn't doing its job.
Aaron Glantz's new book is called The War Comes Home: Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. Aaron, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks also to Think's very talented assistant producer, Brandilyn Barnett. You may have spoken to Brandilyn. He's been our call screener for the past year and helped out with research and our podcast and production. We will miss him. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.